We show people getting ready to fire some artillery at you, General.
How much? Bondarenko asked.
Most I've ever seen, upwards of 1,000 guns total. I hope your people are hunkered down, buddy. The whole damn world's about to land on them.
What can you do to help us? Bondarenko asked.
My orders are not to take action until they start shooting, the American replied. When that happens, I can start putting fighters up, but not much in the way of bombs.
We hardly have any to drop, Wallace reported.
I have an AWACS up now, supporting your fighters in the Chulman area, but that's all for now.
We have a C-130 ferrying you a downlink tomorrow so that we can get you some intelligence directly.
Anyway, be warned, General, it looks here as though the Chinese are going to launch their attack momentarily.
Thank you, General Wallace.
Bondarenko hung up and looked at his staff.
He says it's going to start at any moment.
And so it did. Lieutenant Komonov saw it first. The line of hills his men called Rice Ridge was suddenly backlit by yellow flame that could only be the muzzle flashes of numerous field guns. Then came the upward-flying meteor shapes of artillery rockets.
"Here it comes," he told his men.
Unsurprisingly, he kept his head up so that he could see. His head, he reasoned, was a small target. Before the shells landed, he felt the impact of their firing. The rumble came through the ground like a distant earthquake, causing his loader to mutter, "Oh, shit!" Probably the universal observation of men in their situation.
"Get me regiment," Komonov ordered.
"Yes, Lieutenant," the voice answered.
"We are under attack, Comrade Colonel. Massive artillery fire to the south. Guns and rockets are coming out."
Then the first impacts came, mainly near the river, well to his south. The exploding shells were not bright, but like little sparks of light that fountained dirt upward, followed by the noise. That did sound like an earthquake. Komonov had heard artillery fire before, and seen what the shells do at the far end. But this was as different from that as an exploding oil tank was from a cigarette lighter.
"Comrade Colonel, our country is at war,"
Post 5-6 Alpha reported to command.
"I can't see enemy troop movement yet, but they're coming."
"Do you have any targets?" Regiment asked.
"No, none at this time."
He looked down into the bunker. His various positions could just give a direction to a target. And when another confirmed it and called in its own vector, they'd have a pre-plotted artillery target for the batteries in the rear. But those were being hit already. The Chinese rockets were targeted well behind him, and that's what their targets had to be. He turned his head to see the flashes and hear the booms from 10 kilometers back. A moment later, there was a fountaining explosion skyward. One of the first flight of Chinese rockets had gotten lucky and hit one of the artillery positions in the rear.
Bad news for that gun crew, Komonov thought.
The first casualties in this war. There would be many more, perhaps including himself. Surprisingly, that thought was a distant one. Someone was attacking his country. It wasn't a supposition or a possibility anymore. He could see it and feel it. This was his country they were attacking. He'd grown up in this land. His parents lived here. His grandfather had fought the Germans here. His grandfather's two brothers had, too, and both had died for their country, one west of Kiev and the other at Stalingrad. And now these chink bastards were attacking his country, too? More than that, they were attacking him, Senior Lieutenant Valery Mikhailovich Komonov. These foreigners were trying to kill him, his men, and trying to steal part of his country. Well, fuck that, he thought.
Load, he told his loader.
Loaded, the private announced. They all heard the breech clang shut.
No target, Comrade Lieutenant, the gunner observed.
There will be soon enough.
Post 5-9, this is 5-6 Alpha. What can you see?
We just spotted a boat, a rubber boat, coming out of the trees on the south bank.
More, 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 many of them, maybe 100, maybe more.
Regiment, this is 56 Alpha, fire mission, Komonov called over the phone.
The gunners 10 kilometers back were at their guns, despite the falling Chinese shells and rockets that had already claimed 3 of the 15 gun crews. The fire mission was called in, and the preset concentration dialed in from range books so old they might as well have been engraved in marble. In each case, the high-explosive projectile was rammed into the breech, followed by the propellant charge, and the gun cranked up and trained to the proper elevation and azimuth, and the lanyards pulled, and the first Russian counterstrokes in the war just begun were fired. Unknown to them, 15 kilometers away, a firefinder radar was trained on their positions. The millimeter wave radar tracked the shells in flight, and a computer plotted their launch points. The Chinese knew that the Russians had guns covering the border, and knew roughly where they would be. The performance of the guns told that tale. But not exactly where, because of the skillful Russian efforts at camouflage. In this case, those efforts didn't matter too greatly. The calculated position of 6 Russian howitzers was instantly radioed to rocket launchers that were dedicated counter-battery weapons. One Type 83 launcher was detailed to each target, and each of them held 4 Monster 273mm rockets, each with a payload of 150 kilograms of submunitions. In this case, 80 hand-grenade-sized bomblets. The first rocket launched 3 minutes after the first Russian counterfire salvo, and required less than 2 minutes of flight time from its firing point 10 kilometers inside Chinese territory. Of the first 6 fired, 5 destroyed their targets, and then others, and the Russian gunfire died in less than 5 minutes.
"Why did it stop?" Komonov asked. He'd seen a few rounds hit among the Chinese infantry just getting out of their boats on the Russian side of the river.
But the shriek of shells overhead passing south had just stopped after a few minutes.
"Regiment, this is 5-6 Alpha. Why has our fire stopped?"
"Our guns were taking counter-battery fire from the Chinese. They're trying to get set back up now," was the encouraging reply. "What is your situation?"
"Position 5-0 has taken a little fire, but not much. Mainly they're hitting the reverse slope of the southern ridge."
That was where the fake bunkers were, and the concrete lures were fulfilling their passive mission. This line of defenses had been set up contrary to published Russian doctrine, because whoever had set them up had known that all manner of people can read books. Komonov's own position covered a small saddle pass through 2 hills, fit for advancing tanks. If the Chinese came north in force, if this was not just some sort of probe aimed at expanding their borders — they'd done that back in the late 1960s — this was a prime invasion route. The maps and the terrain decided that.
"That is good, Lieutenant. Now listen, do not expose your positions unnecessarily. Let them in close before you open up. Very close."
That, Komonov knew, meant 100 meters or so. He had 2 heavy machine guns for that eventuality. But he wanted to kill tanks. That was what his main gun had been designed to do.
"Can we expect more artillery support?" he asked his commander.
"I'll let you know. Keep giving us target information."
"Yes, Comrade Colonel."
For the fighter planes, the war began when the first PLA-AF crossed over the Amur. There were 4 Russian fighter interceptors up, and these, just like the invaders, were Sukhoi 27. Those on both sides had been made in the same factories, but the Chinese pilots had tripled the recent flight time of the defending Russians, who were outnumbered 8-1. Countering that, however, was the fact that the Russian aircraft had support from the USAF E-3B Sentry AWACS aircraft, which was guiding them to the intercept. Both sets of fighters were flying with their target acquisition radars in standby mode. The Chinese didn't know what was out there. The Russians did. That was a difference.
"Black Falcon 10, this is Eagle 7. Recommend you come right to new course 270. I'm going to try and bring you up on the Chinese from there 7 o'clock.
It would also keep them out of Chinese radar coverage.
"Understood, Eagle. Coming right to 270.
The Russian flight leader spread his formation out and settled down as much as he could, with his eyes tending to look off to his left.
Okay, Black Falcon 10, that's good. Your targets are now at your 9 o'clock, distance 30 kilometers. Come left now to 180.
Coming left, the Russian major acknowledged. We will try to start the attack Fox 2, he advised.
He knew American terminology. That meant launching infrared seekers, which did not require the use of radar, and so did not warn anyone that he was in harm's way. The Marquess of Queensberry had never been a fighter pilot.
Roger that, Falcon. This boy's smart, the controller commented to his supervisor.
That's how you stay alive in this business, the lieutenant colonel told the young lieutenant at the Nintendo screen.
Okay, Falcon 10, recommend you come left again. Targets are now 15 kilometers. Make that 17 kilometers to your north. You should have tone shortly.
Da, I have tone, the Russian pilot reported, when he heard the warble in his headset.
Flight, prepare to fire. Fox 2.
Three of the four aircraft loosed a single missile each. The fourth pilot was having trouble with his IR scanner. In all cases, the blazing rocket motors wrecked their night vision, but none of the pilots looked away, as they'd been trained to do, and instead watched their missiles streak after fellow airmen who did not yet know they were under attack. It took 20 seconds, and as it turned out, two missiles were targeted on the same Chinese aircraft. That one took two hits and exploded. The second died from its single impact, and then things really got confusing. The Chinese fighters scattered on command from their commander, doing so in a pre-planned and well-rehearsed maneuver, first into two groups, then into four, each of which had a piece of sky to defend. Everyone's radar came on, and in another 20 seconds a total of 40 missiles were flying, and with this began a deadly game of chicken. The radar homing missiles needed a radar signal to guide them, and that meant that the firing fighter could not switch off or turn away. Only hope that his bird would kill its target and switch off his radar before his missile got close.
Damn, the lieutenant observed, in his comfortable controller's seat in the E-3B.
Two more Chinese fighters blinked into larger bogeys on his screen and then started to fade. Then another. But there were just too many of the Chinese air-to-air missiles, and not all of the Chinese illumination radars went down. One Russian fighter took three impacts and disintegrated. Another one limped away with severe damage, and as quickly as it had begun, this air encounter ended. Statistically, it was a Russian win, 4 kills for 1 loss, but the Chinese would claim more.
Any shoots? The senior controller asked over the intercom.
The E-3 radar could track those too.
3, maybe 4 ejected. Not sure who, though. Not till we play the tape back. Damn, that was a quick one.
The Russians didn't have enough planes up to do a proper battle. Maybe next time, the colonel thought. The full capabilities of a fighter AWACS team had never been properly demonstrated in combat. But this war held the promise to change that. And when it happened, some eyes would be opened.
Chapter 51 Falling Back. Senior Lieutenant Valery Mikhailovich Komonov learned something he'd never suspected. The worst part of battle, at least to a man in a fixed emplacement, was knowing that the enemy was out there, but being unable to shoot at him. The reverse slopes of the ridge to his immediate south had to be swarming with Chinese infantry, and his supporting artillery had been taken out in the first minutes of the battle. Whoever had set up the artillery positions had made the mistake of assuming that the guns were too far back and too shielded by terrain for the enemy to strike at them. Firefinder, radar/computer systems had changed that, and the absence of overhead cover had doomed the gun crews to rapid death, unless some of them had found shelter in the concrete-lined trenches built into their positions. He had a powerful gun at his fingertips, but it was one that could not reach over the hills to his south because of its flat trajectory. As envisioned, this defense line would have included leg infantry, who'd depend on and also support the bunker's strong points, and be armed with mortars which could reach over the close-in hills and punish those who were there, but unseen behind the terrain feature.
Komonov could only engage those he could see, and they... "There, comrade lieutenant," the gunner said. "A little right of 12 o'clock, some infantry just crested the ridge. Range 1,500 meters.
"I see them."
There was just a hint of light on the eastern horizon now. Soon there would be enough light to see by. That would make shooting easier, but for both sides. In an hour, his bunker would be targeted, and they'd get to see just how thick their armor protection really was.
5-6 Alpha, this is 5-0. We have infantry 1,100 meters to our south. Company strength and moving north toward us.
Very well. Do not engage until they are within 200 meters. Komonov automatically doubled the shooting range at which he'd been trained to open fire. What the hell, he thought. His crews would do that in their own minds anyway. A man thinks differently when real bullets are flying. As if to emphasize that, shells started landing on the crest immediately behind his position, close enough to make him duck down.
"So they see us?" his loader asked.
"No, they're just barraging the next set of hills to support their infantrymen."
"Look, look there, they're on top of False Bunker 1-6, the gunner said.
Komonov shifted his glasses. Yes, they were there, examining the old KV-2 gun turret with its vertical sides and old 155mm gun. As he watched, a soldier hung a satchel charge on the side and backed away. Then the charge went off, destroying something that had never worked anyway. That would make some Chinese lieutenant feel good, Komonov thought. Well, 5-6 Alpha would change his outlook somewhat, in another 20 or 30 minutes. The bad part was that now he had perfect targets for his supporting artillery, and those old 6-inch guns would have cut through them like a harvester's scythe. Except the Chinese were still hitting those positions, even though the Russian fire had stopped. He called regiment again to relay his information.
"Lieutenant," his colonel answered, "the supporting battery has been badly hit. You are on your own. Keep me posted."
"Yes, comrade colonel. Out."
He looked down at his crew.
"Don't expect supporting fire." The weapons of World War III had just destroyed those of World War I.
"Shit," the loader observed.
"We'll be in the war soon, men. Be at ease. The enemy is now closer."
500 meters, the gunner agreed.
"Well?" General Peng asked at his post atop Rice Ridge. "We found some bunkers, but they are all unoccupied," Colonel Waugh reported. "So far the only fire we've taken has been indirect artillery, and we've counter-batteried that to death. The attack is going completely to plan, Comrade General."
They could see the truth of that. The bridging engineers were rolling up to the south bank of the Amur now, with folded sections of ribbon bridge atop their trucks. Over 100 Type 90 main battle tanks were close to the river, their turrets searching vainly for targets so that they could support the attacking infantry. But there was nothing for them to shoot at. And so the tankers, like the generals, had nothing to do but watch the engineers at work. The first bridge section went into the water, flipping open to form the first 8 meters of highway across the river. Peng checked his watch. Yes, things were going about 5 minutes ahead of schedule, and that was good. Post 5-0 opened up first with its 12.7mm machine gun. The pound of it rattled across the hillside. 5-0 was 3,500 meters to his east, commanded by a bright young sergeant named Ivanov. He opened up too early, Komonov thought, reaching for targets a good 400 meters away. But there was nothing to complain about, and the heavy machine gun could easily reach that far. Yes, he could see bodies crumpling from the heavy slugs. Then a crashing boom as the main gun let loose a single round, and it reached into the saddle they defended, exploding there amidst a squad or so.
"Comrade Lieutenant, can we?" his gunner asked.
"No, not yet." "Patience, Sergeant," Komonov replied, watching to the east to see how the Chinese reacted to the fire. Yes, their tactics were predictable but sound. The lieutenant commanding them first got his men down. Then they set up a base of fire to engage the Russian position, and then they started maneuvering left and right.
A section was setting up something. Something on a tripod. An anti-tank recoilless rifle, probably. He could have turned his gun to take it out, but Komonov didn't want to give away his position yet. 5-0, this is 5-6 Alpha. There's a Chinese recoilless setting up at your 2 o'clock, range 800, he warned.
Yes, I see it, the sergeant replied.
And he had the good sense to engage it with his machine gun. In 2 seconds, the green tracers reached out and ripped through the gun section once, twice, three times, just to be sure. Through his binoculars he could see some twitching, but that was all.
Well done, Sergeant Ivanov. Look out, they're moving to your left under terrain cover.
But there wasn't much of that around here. Every bunker's field of fire had been bulldozed, leveling out almost all of the dead ground within 800 meters of every position.
We shall see about that, Comrade Lieutenant.
And the machine gun spoke again. Return fire was coming in now. Komonov could see tracers bouncing off the turret's thick armor into the sky.
Regiment, 5-6 Alpha here. Post 5-0 is under deliberate attack now from infantry and...
Then more artillery shells started landing. Called in directly on 5-0. He hoped Ivanov was now under his hatch. The turret had a coaxial machine gun, an old but powerful PK with the long 7.62mm cartridge. Komonov let his gunner survey the threat to his bunker while he watched how the Chinese attacked Sergeant Ivanov's. Their infantry moved with some skill, using what ground they had, keeping fire on the exposed gun turret. Enough artillery fell close enough to strip away the bushes that had hidden it at first. Even if your bullets bounced off, they were still a distraction to those inside. It was the big shells that concerned the lieutenant. A direct hit might penetrate the thinner top armor, mightn't it? An hour before, he would have said no. But he could see now what the shells did to the ground, and his confidence had eroded quickly.
"Comrade Lieutenant," his gunner said, "the people headed for us are turning away to attack Ivanov. Look!"
Komonov turned around to see. He didn't need his binoculars. The sky was improving the light he had, and now he could see more than shadows. They were man-shapes, and they were carrying weapons. One section was rushing to his left, three of them carrying something heavy. On reaching a shallow intermediate ridge line, they stopped and started putting something together, some sort of tube. It was an HJ-8 anti-tank missile, his mind told him, fishing up the information from his months of intelligence briefings. They were about 1,000 meters to his left front, within range of Ivanov. And within range of his big dish KM machine gun, Komonov stood on his firing stand and yanked back hard on the charging handle, leveling the gun and sighting carefully. His big tank gun could do this, but so could he.
"So, you want to kill Sergeant Ivanov?" his mind asked.
Then he thumbed the trigger lever, and the big gun shook in his hands. His first burst was about 30 meters short, but his second was right on, and three men fell. He kept firing to make sure he destroyed their rocket launcher. He realized a moment later that the brilliant green tracers had just announced his location for all to see. Tracers work in both directions. That became clear in 2 minutes, when the first artillery shells began landing around position 5-6 Alpha. He only needed one close explosion to drop down and slam his hatch. The hatch was the weakest part of his position's protection, with only a fifth of the protective thickness of the rest. Else he'd be unable to open it, of course. And if a shell hit that, he and his crew would all be dead. The enemy knew their location now, and there was no sense in hiding.
"Sergeant," he told his gunner, "fire at will."
"Yes, Comrade Lieutenant."
And with that the sergeant loosed his first high-explosive round at a machine gun crew 800 meters away. The shell hit the gun itself and vaporized the infantryman operating it.
"There's three good chinks," he exulted. "Load me another."
The turret started turning, and the gunner started hunting.
"Getting some resistance now," Watt told Peng. "There are Russian positions on the southern slope of the second ridge. We're hitting them now with artillery."
"Losses?"
"Light," the operations officer reported, listening in on the tactical radio.
"Good," said General Peng. His attention was almost entirely on the river. The first bridge was about a third complete now.
Those bridging engineers are pretty good, General Wallace thought, watching the take from Marilyn Monroe.
Yes, sir, but it might as well be a peacetime exercise. They're not taking any fire, the junior officer observed, watching another section being tied off. And it's a very efficient bridge design.
Russian?
The major nodded.
Yes, sir. We copied it, too.
How long?
The rate they're going? About an hour, maybe an hour 10.
Back to the gunfight, Wallace ordered.
Sergeant, let's go back to the ridge, the officer told the NCO who was piloting the UAC.
30 seconds later, the screen showed what looked like a tank sunk in the mud surrounded by a bunch of infantrymen.
Jesus, that looks like real fun, Wallace thought.
A fighter pilot by profession, the idea of fighting in the dirt appealed to him about as much as anal sex.
They're not going to last much longer, the major said. Look here, the Gomers are behind some of the bunkers now. And look at all that artillery.
A total of 100 heavy field guns were now pounding Komonov's immobile platoon. That amounted to a full battery fixed on each of them, and heavy as his buried concrete box was, it was shaking now, and the air inside filled with cement dust, as Komonov and his crew struggled to keep up with all the targets.
"This is getting exciting, Comrade Lieutenant," the gunner observed, as he loosed his 15th main gun shot.
Komonov was in his commander's cupola, looking around and seeing, rather to his surprise, that his bunker and all the others under his command could not deal with the attackers. It was a case of intellectual knowledge finally catching up with what his brain had long proclaimed as evident common sense. He actually was not invincible here. Despite his big tank gun and his two heavy machine guns, he could not deal with all these insects buzzing about him. It was like swatting flies with an ice pick. He reckoned that he and his crew had personally killed or wounded 100 or so attackers, but no tanks. Where were the tanks he yearned to kill? He could do that job well. But to deal with infantry, he needed supporting artillery fire, plus foot soldiers of his own. Without them, he was like a big rock on the seacoast, indestructible, but the waves could just wash around him. And they were doing that now, and then Komonov remembered that all the rocks by the sea were worn down by the waves, and eventually toppled by them. His war had lasted 3 hours, not even that much, and he was fully surrounded, and if he wanted to survive, it would soon be time to leave. The thought enraged him. Desert his post? Run away? But then he remembered that he had orders allowing him to do so, if and when his post became untenable. He'd received the orders with a confident chuckle. Run away from an impregnable mini-fortress? What nonsense! But now he was alone. Each of his posts was alone. And the turret rang like an off-tone bell with the direct impact of a heavy shell, and then, "Shit!" the gunner screamed. "Shit, my gun's damaged!" Komonov looked out of one of his vision slits, and yes, he could see it. The gun tube was scorched and actually bent. Was that possible? A gun barrel was the sturdiest structure men could make, but it was slightly bent. And so it was no longer a gun barrel at all, but just an unwieldy steel club. It had fired 34 rounds, but it would fire no more. With that gun, he'd never kill a Chinese tank. Komonov took a deep breath to collect himself and his thoughts. Yes, it was time.
"Prepare the post for destruction," he ordered.
"Now?" the gunner asked incredulously.
"Now," the lieutenant ordered. "Set it up."
There was a drill for this, and they'd practiced it. The loader took a demolition charge and set it among the racked shells. The electrical cable was in a spool, which he played out. The gunner ignored this, cranking the turret right to fire his coaxial machine gun at some approaching soldiers, then turning rapidly the other way to strike at those who'd used his reaction to the other's movement for cover to move themselves. Komonov stepped down from the cupola seat and looked around. There was his bed,
and the table at which they'd all eaten their food, and the toilet room and the shower. This bunker had become home, a place of both comfort and work. But now they had to surrender it to the Chinese. It was almost inconceivable, but it could not be denied. In the movies, they'd fight to the death here, but fighting to the death was a lot more comfortable for actors who could start a new film the next week. "Come on, Sergeant," he ordered his gunner, who took one last long burst before stepping down and heading toward the escape tunnel. Komonov counted off the men as they went, then headed out. He realized he hadn't phoned his intentions back to regiment, and he hesitated. But no, there wasn't time for that now. He'd radio his action from the moving BTR. The tunnel was low enough that they had to run bent over, but it was also lit, and there was the outer door. When the reserve gunner opened it, they were greeted by the much louder sound of falling shells. "You fucking took long enough," a 30-ish sergeant snarled at them. "Come on," he urged, waving them to his BTR-60. "Wait." Komonov took the twist detonator and attached the wire ends to the terminals. He sheltered behind the concrete abutment that contained the steel door and twisted the handle once. The demolition charge was 10 kilograms of TNT. It and the stored shells created an explosion that roared out of the escape tunnel with a sound like the end of the world. And on the far side of the hill, the heavy turret of the never-finished JS-3 tank rocketed skyward, to the amazed pleasure of the Chinese infantrymen. And with that, Komonov's job was done. He turned and followed his men to board the 8-wheeled armored personnel carrier. It was ensconced on a concrete pad under a grass-covered concrete roof that had prevented anyone from seeing it, and now it raced down the hill to the north and safety. "Bugging out," the sergeant told the major, tapping the TV screen taking the feed from Marilyn Monroe. "This bunch just blew up their gun turret. That's the third one to call it a day." "Surprised they lasted this long," General Wallace said. Sitting still in a combat zone was an idea entirely foreign to him. He'd never done fighting while moving slower than 400 knots, and he considered that speed to be practically standing still. "I bet the Russians will be disappointed," the major said. "When do we get the downlink to Chibarsaville?" "Before lunch, sir. We're sending a team down to show them how to use it." The BTR was in many ways the world's ultimate SUV, with 8 driving wheels, the lead 4 of which turned with the steering wheel. The reservist behind that wheel was a truck driver in civilian life, and knew how to drive only with his right foot pressed to the floor, Komonov decided. He and his men bounced inside like dice in a cup, saved from head injury only by their steel helmets. But they didn't complain. Looking out of the rifle firing ports, they could see the impact of Chinese artillery. And the quicker they got away from that, the better they'd all feel. "How was it for you?" the lieutenant asked the sergeant commanding the vehicle. "Mainly we were praying for you to be a coward. What with all those shells falling around us, thank God for whoever built that garage we were hidden in. At least one shell fell directly on it. I nearly shit myself," the reservist reported with refreshing candor. They were communicating in face-to-face shouts. "How long to regimental headquarters?"
"About 10 minutes.
"How many did you get?"
"Maybe 200, Komonov thought, rather generously. "Never saw a tank.
They're probably building their ribbon bridges right now. It takes a while. I saw a lot of that when I was in 8th Guards Army in Germany. Practically all we practiced was crossing rivers. How good are they?"
"They're not cowards. They advance under fire even when you kill some of them."
"What happened to our artillery?"
"Wiped out. Artillery rockets came down like a blanket of hail, Comrade Lieutenant."
"Crump," he replied with a two-handed gesture.
"Where is our support?"
"Who the fuck do you think we are?" the sergeant asked in reply. They were all surprised when the BRT skidded to an unwarned stop.
"What's happening?" he shouted at the driver.
"Look," the man said in reply, pointing. Then the rear hatches jerked open and 10 men scrambled in, making the interior of the BTR as tight as a can of fish.
"Comrade Lieutenant,
It was Ivanov from 50. What happened?
We took a shell on the hatch, he replied, and the bandages on his face told the truth of the tale. He was in some pain, but happy to be moving again.
Our BTR took a direct hit on the nose, killed the driver, and wrecked it.
I've never seen shelling like this.
Not even in exercises in Germany and the Ukraine,
the BTR sergeant said.
Like the war movies, but different when you're really in it.
Duh, Komonov agreed. It was no fun at all, even in his bunker, but especially out here. The sergeant lit up a cigarette, a Japanese one, and held on to the overhead grip to keep from rattling around too much. Fortunately, the driver knew the way, and the Chinese artillery abated, evidently firing at random target sets beyond visual range of their spotters.
It started, Jack, Secretary of Defense Brentano said. I want to release our people to start shooting.
Who exactly?
Air Force, fighter planes we have in theater to start. We have AWACS up and working with the Russians already. There's been one air battle, a little one already. And we're getting feed from reconnaissance assets. I can cross-link them to you if you want.
Okay, do that, Ryan told the phone.
And on the other issue, okay, turn them loose, Jack said. He looked over at Robbie.
Jack, it's what we pay him for, and believe me, they don't mind. Fighter pilots live for this sort of thing. Until they see what happens, though they mainly never do. They just see the broke airplane, not the poor shot-up bleeding bastard inside, trying to eject while he's still conscious, Vice President Jackson explained. Later on, a pilot may think about that a little.
I did.
But not everyone. Mainly you get to paint a kill on the side of your aircraft, and we all want to do that.
Okay, people, we are now in this fight, Colonel Bronco Winters told his assembled pilots. He'd gotten 4 kills over Saudi the previous year, downing those poor, dumb, rag-headed gomers who flew for the country that had brought biological warfare to his own nation. One more and he'd be a no-shit fighter ace, something he dreamed about all the way back to his dually year at Colorado Springs. He'd been flying the F-15 Eagle fighter for his entire career, though he hoped to upgrade to the new F-22A Raptor in 2 or 3 more years. He had 4,231 hours in the Eagle, knew all its tricks, and couldn't imagine a better aircraft to go up in. So now he'd kill Chinese. He didn't understand the politics of the moment and didn't especially care. He was on a Russian airbase, something he'd never expected to see except through a gun sight, but that was okay too. He thought for a moment that he rather liked Chinese food, especially the things they did to vegetables in a wok. But those were American Chinese, not the commie kind, and that, he figured, was that. He'd been in Russia for just over a day, long enough to turn down about 20 offers to snort down some vodka. Their fighter pilot seemed smart enough, maybe a little too eager for their own good, but friendly and respectful when they saw the 4 kills painted on the side panel of his F-15 Charlie, the lead fighter of the 390th Fighter Squadron. He hopped off the Russian jeep, they called it something else that he hadn't caught, at the foot of his fighter. His chief mechanic was there.
"Got her all ready for me, chief?" Winters asked, as he took the first step on the ladder.
"You bet," replied Chief Master Sergeant Neil Nolan. "Everything is top-lined. She's as ready as I can make her. Go kill her some, Bronco."
It was a squadron rule that when a pilot had his hands on his aircraft, he went only by his call sign.
"I'll bring you the scalps, Nolan."
Colonel Winters continued his climb up the ladder, patting the decorated panel as he went. Chief Master Sergeant Nolan scurried up to help him strap in, then dropped off, detached the ladder, and got clear. Winters began his startup procedures, first of all entering his ground coordinates, something they still did on the Eagle despite the new GPS locator systems, because the F-15C had inertial navigation in case it broke. It never did, but procedure was procedure. The instruments came online telling Winters that his Eagle's conformal fuel tanks were topped off, and he had a full load of 4 AIM-120 MRAM radar-guided missiles, plus 4 more of the brand-new AIM-9X Sidewinders,
the Super Snake version of a missile whose design went back to before his mom and dad had married in a church up on Lenox Avenue in Harlem.
Tower, this is Bronco with 3 ready to taxi. Over.
Tower, Bronco, you are cleared to taxi. Wind is 305 at 10. Good luck, Colonel.
Thank you, Tower.
Bors, this is lead. Let's get going.
With that, he tripped his brakes and the fighter started moving, driven by its powerful Pratt & Whitney engines. A bunch of Russians, mainly ground crewmen, but judging by the outfits, some drivers as well, were out on the ramp watching him and his flight.
Okay, he thought. We'll show 'em how we do things downtown.
The 4 taxied in pairs to the end of the runway and then roared down the concrete slabs and pulled back into the air, wingmen tucked in tight. Seconds later, the other 2 pulled up and they turned south, already talking to the nearest AWACS, Eagle 2.
Eagle 2, this is Boer Leader in the air with 4.
Boer Leader, this is Eagle 2. We have you. Come south, vector 170. Climb and maintain flight level 33.
Looks like there's going to be some work for you today. Over.
Suits me. Out.
Colonel Winters, he'd just been deep dip selected for his bird as a full bull colonel, wiggled a little in his seat to get things just right, and finished his climb to 33,000 feet. His radar system was off, and he wouldn't speak unnecessarily because someone out there might be listening. And why spoil the surprise? In a few minutes, he'd be entering the coverage of Chinese border radar stations. Somebody would have to do something about that. Later today, he hoped, the little weasel F-16s would go and see about those. But his job was Chinese fighter aircraft, and any bombers that might offer themselves. His orders were to remain over Russian airspace for the entire mission, and so if Joe Chink didn't want to come out and play, it would be a dull day. But Joe had Su-27s, and he thought those were pretty good. And Joe Chink, fighter pilot, probably thought he was pretty good, too. So they'd just have to see. Otherwise, it was a good day for flying, 2/10 clouds and nice, clean country air to fly in. His Falcon's eyes could see well over 100 miles from up here, and he had Eagle 2 to tell him where the Gomers were. Behind him, a second and third flight of 4 Eagles were each taking off. The Wild Boars would be fully represented today. The train ride was fairly jerky. Lieutenant Colonel Giusti squirmed in his upright coach seat, trying to get a little bit comfortable. But the Russian-made coach in which he and his staff were riding hadn't been designed with creature comforts in mind, and there was no sense grumbling about it. It was dark outside, the early morning that children sensibly take to be nighttime, and there wasn't much in the way of lights out there. They were in eastern Poland now, farm country probably, as Poland was evolving into the Iowa of Europe. Lots of pig farms to make the ham for which this part of the world was famous. Vodka, too, probably, and Colonel Giusti wouldn't have minded a snort of that at the moment. He stood and walked down the aisle of the car. Nearly everyone aboard was asleep, or trying to be. 2 sensible NCOs were stretched out on the floor instead of curled up on the seats. The dirty floor wouldn't do their uniforms much good, but they were heading to combat operations where neatness didn't really count all that much. Personal weapons were invariably stowed in the overhead racks, in the open for easy access, because they were all soldiers, and they didn't feel very comfortable without a usable weapon close by. He continued aft. The next coach had more troopers from headquarters company. His squadron sergeant major was in the back of that one, reading a paperback.